This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Mad Men, the Emmy-winning AMC drama about a Madison Avenue advertising executive in the 1960s, won't be presenting new episodes until next year. But it will be back for season 5. The network and the show's creator just agreed to terms which will continue Mad Men through its 7th and final season. Our guest, John Hamm, stars as Don Draper, a creative director at the advertising agency, who epitomizes the creative, troubled, handsome, sexist, cigarette-smoking, liquor-drinking man of the 1960s. But in the most recent season, which just came out this week on DVD, he's gone off the rails. He started a new agency, ended his marriage, and done an awful lot of drinking. And not just during the film's legendary 3-martini business lunches. In this scene, Don has just won a Clio Award, the ad world equivalent of an Emmy or Oscar, and after the celebratory party, holds an ad hoc meeting with a potential client, the representatives of Life Business Cereal. The meeting had been canceled earlier in the day, but Don takes the opportunity to pitch them anyway. And when they reject his first concept, the obviously inebriated Don Draper tries again.
How about life is just a bowl of Life cereal? Life is sweet. Enjoy the rest of your life. Cereal.
Don, they're not expecting you to do this right now.
Give me a second. Life, the reason to get out of bed in the morning. Life, the cure for the common breakfast. Life, its sweetness never ends. Life, eat it by the bowlful.
Oh, there you go. Cure for the common breakfast. Love it.
It's got the health angle. Life makes you feel better. It's got protein. Very nice.
That dog will hunt.
Wonderful. We'll get that put together for you.
John Hamm, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is really wonderful to have you here. This has been such a transformative season for your character, Don Draper. This season, oh man, it's been a rough season. Don Draper has become an out-and-out alcoholic. And
a less functioning alcoholic.
A less functioning alcoholic, exactly. And you've been blowing it at pitch meetings. And what makes Don Draper's behavior even worse in that scene is that the slogan that the clients from Life Cereal like best is one that Draper actually lifted from the portfolio of a job candidate. And he's so drunk he doesn't even realize he did that.
Unconsciously.
Yeah. So John Hamm, did you have to rethink your whole portrayal this season of who Don Draper is? And this season starts with a journalist saying to Don Draper, who is Don Draper? And the whole season has been basically asking that question.
I think yes and no. I think the character has and is evolving. And certainly circumstances in Don Draper's life have changed. Don's getting older. The country is moving through a significant period of change.
His wife has left him. She's remarried. He's living alone in Greenwich Village. Even he's propositioned, well, he slept with his secretary, which was a terrible thing to do, and then kind of ditches her and fires her.
She resigns.
She resigns, okay. Who would stay under those circumstances? And then also, I mean, even you've even lost your touch with women. I mean, things are kind of getting back to an even keel, but like you've propositioned women who've turned you down, it's kind of rough.
Well, I think this character is evolving, and what is happening is, in my opinion, and I think Matt Weiner, the show's creator, would agree with me, is that Don is sort of losing touch with not only his life but with the world around him. And as the world is changing, as he is getting older, as his circumstances are shifting, the old paradigms aren't working so much anymore. But it definitely is a season about redefining who you are. When all of that stuff gets stripped away, when you no longer have the perfect wife and the perfect family and the perfect job and the perfect approach to every problem, when all of that stuff gets stripped away, who are you at the foundation? And as we know about Don Draper, he's not honest with the world about who he is. And so his fundamental dishonesty needs to be addressed before any sort of real growth can happen, and it remains to be seen if he's strong enough to do that.
There was recently on Mad Men a real turning point scene. It's the scene where you basically reach bottom, you bottom out, and it's after this scene that you realize something has to change in your life and you try to start cutting back on the alcohol. But this is a scene where you've gotten so drunk after someone who was very important to you has died, that Peggy, one of the women you work with, basically has to drag you into the restroom where you're kneeling in front of the toilet and just heaving and heaving. And when you come out of it, there's even like a yellow puke stain on your shirt. And so it's like we are seeing you at your lowest. And everybody who has just thought of Don Draper as this, like, you know, handsome guy and everything, we're seeing the consequences of all of Don Draper's actions play out. And I'm just wondering what it was like for you to shoot that scene where he is at his lowest.
It was a tremendously kind of exciting and cathartic and sad and wonderful scene to film. And, you know, Matt, very early on in the series, states...
This is Matt Weiner, the creator.
Matt Weiner, yes, sorry, the writer and creator, executive producer of the show. Stated very on that one of the driving principles of the show is that actions have consequences. And I think some of the early criticism of the show is like, well, these actions don't have consequences. Like, this guy gets away with everything. He's a liar. He cheats on his wife. Nothing ever happens, blah, blah, blah. And what we're now finding out is, well, they don't necessarily have to have consequences on the same day or in the same episode or in the same hour of television, but they will have consequences. And we are seeing the consequences of three seasons of behavior kind of come to a head in this particular episode.
At what point did you find out that your character, Don Draper, was going to undergo this transformational change and that the consequences would catch up with him this season?
Well, I trusted in Matt to tell the story the way he wanted to tell the story and to be honest about it. And again, as I said, very early on, he said actions will have consequences. So I imagined that this would come about at some point. We don't really talk in specifics about how the show is going to progress episode to episode and season-long arcs. So, and we're not really allowed in the writer's room to go sort of peek and see where our people are going and what's going to happen. And I honestly really don't like knowing like what's going to come down the pike, for fear of somehow subconsciously playing the end of the story or playing information that my character shouldn't have. That said, Matt and I sit at the beginning of every season and we talk about what the season is going to bring and what the arc of the season could be or should be or might be. But this is well before anything is written, and we talk in very, very general terms and themes and feelings and ideas.
Now, you auditioned for the part of Don Draper 6 times, at least that's what I read. So when you were doing the audition, you had to portray a Don Draper confidence. But because you hadn't landed a really big role before, you were probably, as many actors are, insecure at the time of the audition. You were still a waiter, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you probably didn't have quite the confidence that you had to convey. Or maybe you did, but I'm wondering how confidence came into play during the audition.
Well, you have to, I mean, as any actor, you have to, and this is successful, unsuccessful, working, non-working, you have to portray a sense of confidence. And if you have to manufacture it, if you have to fake it, if you have to drum it up from somewhere in your subconscious, you have to do it. So I was, and I had worked as an actor, and was on a television show and had a lot of experience. So I wasn't coming in fresh off the turnip truck, so to speak. But auditioning is a terrifying process, and it's a really soul-crushing process sometimes, because essentially what people are saying is not necessarily that we don't like your acting, but we don't like you. And that's hard to take. I really wanted to do this part, and I really felt a relationship to it.
Why? Why did you feel a relationship to it?
I've said it in other interviews, but this character very much reminded me of my father. And my dad would have been 27 years old in 1960 when we start the show. So he would have been a little younger than Don Draper, but he was a very powerful businessman, you know, in St. Louis, Missouri, where I grew up, and had a lot of friends and knew a lot of people and had a lot of power and had a lot of connections, and was a pretty sad guy. Not because he subsumed somebody's identity and had a basic, you know, fundamental lie that he was living, but he, you know, my father was twice widowed and had a tough time, and so it was interesting. It just resonated for me in that respect. So I really wanted to do it, and I thought the writing was excellent, as has been borne out. And I wanted to make the best of the opportunity. So I feel like I did represent confidence walking into the room, and the next seven times I had to walk into the room, I tried to be as confident as I could coming back.
You were very funny in 30 Rock, playing a doctor who was dating Tina Fey. And because you're so handsome, when you go to a restaurant together, women send over drinks, and the waitress gives you free food. The mayor comes over and wants to dance with you. And Alec Baldwin explains to Tina Fey that this is because beautiful people are treated differently than moderately plain-looking people. They live in a bubble, and the bubble is a world of free drinks, kindness, and outdoor sex. So I want to play a scene after Alec Baldwin explains that. And you and Tina Fey are in a restaurant, and you want to order something off the menu. And Tina Fey says, no, I'm going to order for you. And she covers your face with a menu so that the waitress can't see how handsome you are. And then she orders. Here's the scene.
Let me order that for you. Excuse me. We will have a turkey burger deluxe and a catfish po' boy with a diet raspberry Fanta.
I'm going to come back in 5 minutes. You try to order off the menu again, I will smack those glasses off your face.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
What was that? Why didn't she call you sweetheart? And where's the complimentary app sampler? What's going on?
Okay, Drew, this is how most people live. See, because of your whole, you know, Disney Prince thing.
Actually, they used footage of me from my high school swim team to draw Prince Eric.
Right. Because of that, you live in a bubble where people do what you want and tell you what you want to hear.
Oh, I don't think that's true.
Drew, I'm going to tell you this for your own good. You can't put Gatorade on salmon.
Oh, yes, you can. The hot Italian lady from the Food Network told me so.
Did she say it on TV?
No, she said it to me when she jumped escalators to try to talk. Oh. Well, I don't want to live that way. I don't want you to treat me that way.
Are you sure?
Yeah, Liz, I'm an adult. You can be honest with me. I can take it.
Well, you can't really take it, as it turns out. So do you ever feel like you live in that bubble, the bubble of beautiful people?
I certainly don't. I don't consider myself some sort of beautiful person by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think that our culture sort of does that in a certain sense with celebrities in some capacity. It is, I think that is the larger point of that whole storyline is a comment on that, how our culture is sort of obsessed with the beautiful people and treating them just so, because you desperately want to be part of that group. I don't feel that way. I have enough self-loathing and cynicism in me to autocorrect at any particular time.
So you're very funny at satirizing, you know, Don Draper and perceptions of you. You hosted Saturday Night Live a couple of times, and on one of those episodes, you did a sketch called Don Draper's Guide to Picking Up Women. And I just want to play some of that.
And now, Don Draper's Guide to Picking Up Women.
Hello, I'm Don Draper, and I've been fortunate enough to have affairs with many women. Some say, boy, Don, how do you do it? Well, it's simple. And you can do it, too, if you follow my four easy steps. Step one, when in doubt, remain absolutely silent.
Hi, I'm Jessica. A little shy, aren't we? Marry me, I want to have your children.
See? Step two, when asked about your past, give vague, open-ended answers.
So, Dawn, tell me about your family. Any brothers and sisters?
There was a man with bright, shiny shoes. I saw him dancing until the accident.
Oh, how mysterious.
Step three,
I have a great name.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Snurpus.
Well, hello.
Don Draper.
Let's get me out of this skirt.
And finally, step four. Look fantastic in a suit. Look fantastic in casual wear. Look fantastic in anything. Sound good, smell good, kiss good. Strut around with supreme confidence. Be uncannily successful at your job. Blow people away every time you say anything. Take six-hour lunches. Disappear for weeks at a time. Lie to everyone about everything. Can drink and smoke constantly. Basically, be Don Draper.
This has been Don Draper's Guide to Picking Up Women.
It's my guest, John Hamm, on Saturday Night Live. Who wrote that sketch?
I don't know who wrote that one. I'm not sure, honestly. The interesting thing about that, and I haven't heard that clip in quite some time, is that you can hear Matt Weiner laughing in the crowd reactions. He has a very particular
Seriously?
Laugh.
Really?
Yes.
He was in the audience?
He was in the audience that night. That was the first time I hosted, and quite a few of our cast and crew were in attendance. And I could pick it out. I could hear it. It's very funny.
Were you confident in your dating years?
Not particularly. I was sort of a late bloomer and was not really necessarily one of the cool kids and not really. I mean, I was just kind of like the sort of weird kid that didn't do much of anything, actually.
No,
that should be enough to show you how awkward I was when I was dating. I can't even talk about it.
Now, earlier in our interview, you said that the portrayal of Don Draper is based in part on your father, who was a businessman, who was a very successful businessman, but also very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Do you mean depression, or?
Well, he had a sad life in a lot of ways. His first wife.
Your mother?
No.
No?
His first wife. My mother was his second wife. His first wife was... he had two daughters with, and she died of a brain aneurysm very suddenly and very tragically, leaving him to sort of take care of these two little girls. And that was difficult for him. He then met and married my mother, who was much younger than he was, and had me, and then got divorced. And my mother was out of that relationship pretty quick. So then had, you know, three kids and no wife, and... And was ended up sort of back home living with his mom. And then when my mother passed away when I was 10, I then had to move back in with my dad and my grandmother, his mother. So, he was a sad guy. You know, he had a lot of, I think he probably had a lot of regret in his life. And, it was the best way I could describe it is that it was a tricky situation.
A lot of people start off in their path toward adulthood on the path that their parents want them to take, whether that means, you know, going to college when they didn't want to, or, you know, going into business when they'd prefer to be an artist, or, you know, whatever. But since you lost your mother when you were young and your father died when you were 20, you no longer had parents to either displease or please. So, like, they no longer had any say. And I'm wondering how that affected, if at all, your decision to give acting a shot, which is a very, very risky decision.
I'm sure it had some effect. I'm virtually certain, 100%, that had both my parents been around, I probably would have done something completely different with my life. But, you know, I think all performers come from a place of sort of self-doubt and pain and you know, Ray Romano said once very accurately and hilariously that if his dad would have spent more time with him, he probably would have become an accountant instead of a comedian. So I think that anybody that wants to get up on stage and tell jokes or do plays or sing songs has some sort of, at a fundamental level, desire to be paid attention to. And I am no different. But my mother, very, very early on, instilled in me an incredible desire to learn and an incredible curiosity about the world and an incredible joy in achieving things. And so that's probably and she also put me in creative writing classes and acting classes when I was a little kid and encouraged me to do stuff. And so that's probably the biggest influence in what got me here.
Well, John Hamm, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
John Hamm speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. The latest season of Mad Men came out on DVD this week, and the next season will begin on AMC early next year. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, David Mitchell, was recently described by Dave Eggers as one of the more fascinating and fearless writers alive. Mitchell is the author of The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, the historical novel that is now out in paperback. It's a bestseller in America, topped the bestseller list in England, and was nominated for the Man Booker Prize, Britain's most prestigious literary award. The novel is Mitchell's first foray into historical fiction, and it came as a surprise to readers who were used to his postmodern experimental novels. The narrative of The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet begins in 1799. De Zoet has left his home in Amsterdam to work on a small island in Japan as a bookkeeper for the Dutch East Indies Trading Company. The island is called Dejima. Terry Gross spoke with David Mitchell last year.
David Mitchell, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start with a reading from your new book, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet.
With pleasure. It's the morning of July the 26th, 1799.
And where are we in the story at this point?
We're just at the beginning of the novel, when the protagonist, Jacob de Zoet, is about to depart from the ship, the Shenandoah, that's brought him all the way from Batavia, which is modern-day Jakarta, to Nagasaki. He's sitting on the small boat that will take him from the ship to the island of Dejima, a man-made island in Nagasaki Harbour that serves as the Dutch East Indies trading post.
Okay, now for the reading.
Hatless and broiling in his blue dress coat, Jacob de Zoet is thinking of a day 10 months ago when a vengeful North Sea charged the dikes at Domburg and Spindrift tumbled along Church Street, past the parsonage where his uncle presented him with an oiled canvas bag. It contained a scarred psalm book bound in deerskin, and Jacob can, more or less, reconstruct his uncle's speech from memory. Well, heaven knows, nephew, you have heard this book's history often enough. Your great-great-grandfather was in Venice when the plague arrived. His body erupted in buboes the size of frogs, but he prayed from this psalm book, and God cured him. 50 years ago, your grandfather Tice was soldiering in the Palatine when ambushes surprised his regiment. This psalm book stopped this musket ball, he fingers the leaden bullet still in its crater, from shredding his heart. It is a literal truth that I, your father, and you, and your sister, Geertje, owe this book our very existences. Now, we're not papists. We do not ascribe magical powers to bent nails or old rags. But you understand how this sacred book is, by our faith, bound to our bloodline. It is a gift from your ancestors and a loan from your descendants. Whatever befalls you in the years ahead, never forget. This psalm book, he touches the canvas bag, this is your passport home. David's Psalms are a Bible within the Bible. Pray from it, heed its teachings, and you shall not stray. Protect it with your life, that it may nourish your soul. Go now, Jacob, and God go with you. Protect it with your life, Jacob mutters under his breath, which is, he thinks, the crux of my dilemma.
Why is that the crux of Jacob's dilemma?
Well, the dilemma is that at this point in Japanese history, whenever a European came ashore to man the trading post, any Christian artifact, a crucifix, a St. Christopher, or a Bible, or indeed a psalm book, they were supposed to surrender them to the Japanese authorities. They'd be sealed in a barrel for the duration of the visitor's stay on Dejima and only handed back on their departure. For Jacob, who's a pious, God-fearing young man, this is tantamount to apostasy. And even though he's a very honest man who's never broken a rule in his life under ordinary circumstances, he can't obey this rule. It would be like spitting on an image of Jesus, and he just can't do it. So he's having to smuggle this psalm book ashore amongst his other books, and he's just hoping that it won't be noticed, because if it is, he doesn't really know what will happen to him.
Why did the Japanese not allow Christian artifacts of any sort onto the island that you write about?
That's a deep historical question, Terry. They had a fear and loathing of the Christian religion. In the 17th century, the Spanish and the Portuguese, Jesuits and Franciscans, were very active in proselytizing in Japan and converted certainly a low number of millions of Japanese people to the religion. There was an uprising, a peasants' rebellion, and this quickly acquired the hue of a Christian revolution, really. And from that point on, the Edo authorities realised that this foreign religion would be threatening the status quo, which they were very happy with. And so increasingly there were anti-Christian laws passed, culminating, in fact, in the closure of the country to all foreigners except a handful of people working for the Dutch East Indies Company, hence the novel.
Why did you want to set your novel on this island?
Well, it seemed fascinating to me. People do know Japan was closed on the whole. If they've seen James Clavell's Shogun or something like that, that's fairly common knowledge. But it isn't widely known that actually it wasn't, that there was this little keyhole that was kept open the whole of the time. For 250 years, Dejima was the only trading post through which Europeans could trade with Japan, specifically the Dutch East Indies Company. And through it passed, obviously, goods, materials, but also ideas and knowledge. Knowledge about Europe and, indeed, what was happening in the rest of the world could enter Japan, and knowledge about this mysterious kingdom that was closed to the outside world. It's a place where the two cultures could meet, the only place where Western culture and Japanese society could meet. The Dutch were very circumscribed, however. They weren't allowed to leave Dejima, and the only three types of people allowed on were merchants and courtesans and translators, who were father-to-son kind of business. And this confinement was attractive. If there's no way off, if there's no way out of the situation, then human neuroses have no choice but to bloom and bear their own dramatic fruit. So, yeah, there were a lot of baits that attracted me as a novelist that made my curiosity say, this is your next book.
So why did you want to write a historical novel?
Well, really, because I found Dejima, and Dejima hasn't existed for 160 years as a working trading post, and so to do justice to that theme, I had to go back in time. I thought it'd be relatively straightforward. I thought historical fiction was just one more genre, but little did I know. I went wrong twice and had to throw aside about 18 months worth of work at one point, but eventually, by going wrong, I slowly began to work out how I could go right, and this historical novel grew out of that.
What was one of the mistakes that you made when you went wrong?
Language. That was the biggest, baddest mistake, really, Terry. What language did these people speak in? If you try to get it right, if you try to get authentic 18th century speech, you end up sounding like Blackadder. You end up sounding like pastiche. If, on the other hand, you don't convince your reader that the language, you know, smells authentic, then a bubble of fiction is popped because the reader's thinking, hang on, this sounds like speech that could have been from a sitcom I saw last week. So you have to sort of create what I came to think of as a bygone-ese kind of dialect, which is not, in fact, completely plausible. It doesn't really work if you have characters using the word hearken, for example, but which still smells and has the right texture of 18th century speech. And it's tough to do that. It's tough to work out exactly how to do it.
And then you have to be consistent once you've figured it out.
Well, you have to be consistent, and then, of course, you have to avoid the trap where my rather large cast in this book, I think someone somewhere worked out there's about 150 speaking parts in it, they mustn't all sound the same, because that also pricks the bubble of fiction. That also makes the reader think, well, why are all these people speaking the same voice? That doesn't happen in life. So you have to work out bygone ease, but then subdivide it amongst the Dutch, the Japanese, the British.
It sounds like you really made life hard for yourself.
Oh, I did. I did. I do. But of course, it's those strictures. It's that straitjacket. The better tied straitjacket, the more spectacular the act of escapology has to be to get out of a straitjacket. And maybe that's what originality is. It's the confinements that you choose at the beginning, rather like the confinements that the Dutch were under on Dejima, in fact.
Well, I'm glad you brought up originality because, you know, early on you were playing with conventional narrative in your novels. Did you start to feel at some point that the attempt to be original was kind of hopeless because everything's been tried, every experiment's been done, and at some point what you want to do is just be really, really good at whatever whatever it is you're doing?
Well, I do aspire to be that. It's a lifelong job, though, before you're worthy to sweep up the crumbs under the table of the masters.
But you know what I mean? Sometimes, like when I was in my early 20s, I guess, I got so excited by avant-garde music, by new music, by the avant-garde end of classical music, and because they were playing with structure in a way that I found so thrilling. And also, you didn't have to know everything about classical music to get what they were doing. Maybe if I knew more, I would have gotten more of it. But at some point, I wanted more melody in my life and more yeah, more harmony yeah. in my life.
Sure. You want to be able to hum the tune, don't you?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's natural for youth to be drawn to newness because the world is still new for them. And there's a feeling that you can take part in shaping it and changing it and turning it into something new in your image. But then you age, inevitably. I look in the mirror now and I think, wow, it's Dad. And and I am a dad and I am a husband. And these sort of messy, human, muddy themes become much more interesting. And you also realise that structure, originality and innovation, it's not actually a story. They're useful ingredients for art, but it's not art itself, not really. You might be able to admire it, but you certainly can't fall in love with it as a piece of music or as a piece of narrative. Yeah, you go back in a way to older, more traditional forms. You also come to accept that actually Shakespeare cleaned everything up. There's no new turf after him, really. All the postmodern themes, the play within the play, metafiction, it's already been done in the 17th century. You can't win. But art isn't the what, art is the how. Lowell said this really well. If you try to write about the universe, you'll end up staring at the bricks at the bottom of your garden. But if you start with those bricks, you may well end up writing something new about the universe. To start with the people. People are why I fall in love with a book. If you start there, then you can kind of allow ideas and maybe allow innovation and a new structure to sort of grow organically from these stem cells of people. But I think you need to start with the people and how they interact, which is your plot.
You've written about how, as a boy, you had a very bad stammer. Mm. And there's still, I guess, elements of that left, but...
Oh, sure, sure.
Yeah.
It's my lifelong companion.
You write something I thought was very funny and very true. You wrote, "The willpower myth maintains that a stammerer is analogous to a newly wheelchair-bound character in a heartwarming American film. The doctor says he'll never walk again, but his gritty determination proves them wrong. This myth, you say, cost me angry years of believing that I stammered because I wasn't trying hard enough not to stammer." Would you describe what you tried to do during those angry years?
Firstly, I should apologise for the adjective American in that sentence because the British are also equally capable of making such films.
Okay.
What I went through in those years, sort of a state of civil war with myself, really. It took a long, long time to understand that a stammer is more like a kind of a force field. And the more you throw at it, the more it throws back at you. You sort of have to outwit it rather than outfight it. And in a way, not even outwit it. You sort of, I think of it now as a kind of a companion. It's a part of me. It has a right to exist, as I do. And I need to sort of come to a working accommodation with it. And this involves certain strategies and techniques that you can sort of encrypt into how you speak so that so that I'm able to do this interview, for example, which 20 years ago would have been unthinkable. And in the end, these strategies can become so well integrated into who you are and how you speak that they become behaviour and speech patterns rather than techniques.
It must have been so frustrating because you're Mr. Language. You know, I mean, you're all about language. And when you opened your mouth, it wouldn't come out smoothly, yet I'm sure you were writing even as a teenager. And
frustrating, yes.
So people would make fun of you because of your stammer, yet you probably knew so much more about language and were so much more facile with language than the people who were mocking you.
In part, yes, because of my stammer. This is why I view my stammer now as a companion and not an enemy. I might have been a writer without it, but I certainly wouldn't have been this writer. One of the strategies I was referring to, which you meet quite early on in your career as a stammerer, is you auto-cue sentences ahead of time. You see what words are coming up, and say right now I'd have difficulties with words beginning with S. Certainly as a younger person, if I saw an S word was approaching, then I would try and re-engineer that sentence to avoid needing that S word. And this teaches you how language can be employed many, many different ways to say the same thing.
Now, you lived for 8 years in Japan and taught English there to Japanese students.
Yeah.
But from what I've read of your personal essays, you never really spoke fluent Japanese, and you always felt a little challenged by that. So how did that affect your stammer, being like having to really think what each word was before you said it because it wasn't your language? Did that make the stammer any better or worse?
I think the practical problems of learning Japanese would probably sort of trump, by this point, the problems that my stammer would cause me. So, not particularly. You do stammer in a foreign language, by the way. People sometimes think you don't, but you do. You don't stammer when you're singing or talking to animals or speaking on your own in a room, but you do stammer in a foreign language.
You don't stammer when you're talking to animals?
No. You see,
why
it's all
that?
To do with... I've thought about this a lot, but I think, and you may have some speech therapists listening to this program who could have a different point of view, but it's to do with what you think is going on in the listener's head. If you can have a certain militancy about it, if you can think that, I frankly don't care if I'm about to stammer or not. I don't care if this person thinks I'm weird. I don't care if this person thinks any less of me. Then, miraculously, kind of the fingers of the stammer loosen and suddenly you're more fluent again. Obviously, an animal isn't thinking in these terms. So when you're speaking to an animal, you don't stammer.
You know, I'm thinking you have this problem with a stammer. So speaking has always had obstacles and the threat of failure, right?
Yeah.
And you're a writer, like language is your thing. So what do you do? Mm. You spend 8 years living in a country whose language is so different from yours, setting up yet another set of obstacles for communicating verbally through language. It almost seems like the stammer wasn't enough. You had to set up more obstacles. You had to make it a little bit harder.
Yeah, maybe so. Maybe I thrive on obstacles. Yeah. Yeah, there might be something in that. But I think originality needs it. A book that's easily written. You know, you can always tell. You can always tell when the writer hasn't broken out in a sweat trying to land this book. And maybe something of the same can be said in life. If life is obstacle-less, if you're just coasting along without responsibilities, without duties, without sort of having to take care of an elderly relative or an offspring with special needs or whatever, well, perhaps that's what existential malaise is. Maybe that's sort of when you start to drift and have problems of another type. Maybe your problems and your obstacles, rather like your stammer, is in fact a kind of friend in disguise for you. I don't know if we're venturing into self-help territory too much here, but it's something that I kind of believe in.
Well, David Mitchell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Terry. Thank you for having me on your program.
Author David Mitchell speaking to Terry Gross in 2010. His best-selling historical novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, is now out in paperback. Film critic David Edelstein looks at two new movies opening today, the sci-fi thriller Source Code and the haunted house horror flick Insidious. Here are his reviews.
As a critic, I've been accused of giving away plot turns, which I try not to do. I know how much fun it is to be surprised by where a movie goes, which is why I refuse to watch coming attractions. But sometimes, even spelling out the premise of a movie is a kind of spoiler. The less you know about two new popcorn movies, Source Code and Insidious, the better. Some of the air goes out when at last you get your bearings. Source Code is a thriller, that you know from the poster, and it's shot and edited for maximum discombobulation. The protagonist, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, is as disoriented as we are. He wakes up from a nap on what appears to be a Chicago commuter train and is either a yuppie named Sean or an Afghan-based soldier named Coulter. He's sitting opposite a lovely stranger, played by Michelle Monaghan, who appears to know him. Director Duncan Jones made a sci-fi picture called Moon that was both twisty and poignant, and the tone is similar in Source Code. Both films seem inspired by Philip K. Dick's time-bending, mind-bending paranoid thrillers, in which the government has the means to take away your memories or give you false ones, to put your very identity in doubt. There's a touch here, too, of the great Bill Murray comedy Groundhog Day, in which a man experiences over and over a fixed segment of time, gathering new information with each loop. Eventually, Gyllenhaal's Sean, or maybe Coulter, trusts the woman sitting opposite him enough to take her into his confidence.
How well do you know me?
Not that well, apparently.
Do you know me well enough that if I did something that looked a little strange and was maybe even a little bit dangerous, but I told you to trust me anyway, that you could do that?
No.
Wow, that was honest. You're beautiful, you're kind, and you're painfully honest.
Who are you? What did you do with Sean Fentress?
It's the new me.
Gyllenhaal and Monaghan have wonderful chemistry. He with his huge, unblinking baby blues, and she with her irrepressible glow. You really want them to be together, even if they've only just met. When the revelations eventually come, they're preposterous, and the denouement is both cornball and a cheat. But Source Code is so dazzlingly staged and shot and has so much emotional heft that it never loses that exhilarating jitter. The chiller Insidious, alas, does lose a lot in the final half hour, but until then, it's very unnerving. It's the work of the director James Wan and writer Lee Whannell, who gave the world the torture porn Saw franchise and have now joined forces with the producers of the low-tech Haunted House Paranormal Activity franchise. In Insidious, they're going for that Paranormal Activity feel, a lot of bumps and thumps and entities half-glimpsed, but with glossier production values and louder music. Early on, a couple played by Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne hears the cries of their little boy, Dalton, who has wandered into the attic of their new, old house.
Dalton! Honey, where are you?
Stay here. Foster, stay with your sister.
Dalton!
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 What are you doing climbing the ladder?
Honey.
Are you okay? What hurts? What hurts?
My leg.
All right. Can you move it? Can you move your leg? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, man. What happened to your head? Oh, gosh.
Scraped it.
Okay.
Honey, you cannot come up here, okay? Do not explore anymore. It's very dangerous, okay? It's off limits now.
That's one of the scariest scenes in Insidious. We don't know what happened to Dalton in that attic. And when he suddenly goes into a coma, we don't know if he's possessed or if his spirit is now far away in some nightmarish other realm. I'm a sucker for those bumps in the night and flickering lights and simple, no-effects scenes like the one in which Byrne locks the front door, checks another room, and returns to see that front door wide open. But then a trio of ghost hunters arrives, and with them an explanation for what's happening. And then come the splashy special effects reminiscent of Poltergeist and a feeling of déjà vu. Been there, been bombarded by that. People complain about critics giving spoilers, but what about movies that tell you too much too soon and spoil themselves?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Fred Snyder, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.